You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 23rd. 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. However, not in the literal nor metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District. I am remote, halfway to vacation, as it were. But just because I'm halfway to vacation doesn't mean you're going to get a halfway to vacation show. No, indeed, ladies and gentlemen, today we are jam-packed. It's Casual Friday. So the wonderful Cliff Schechter will be here with us. Also, as is tradition, when I'm about to head out to town, out of town, we have Matthew Film Guy to recommend some movies for me. There's some controversy this week. He recommended a movie for me last time around that apparently is not available anywhere. We will take that up with him. Also on the program today, jam-packed, more NSA revelations and a very strange turn of events wherein there seems to be something going on with a rival newspaper in Britain publishing supposed leaks from Snowden, and Snowden denies he ever gave the leaks to them. He says he only worked with specific journalists. Those journalists haven't talked to that UK other publication. Glenn Greenwald is not quite accusing this other publication of working in cahoots with the government. It's a fascinating story. We will get to it. Also on the program today, the Republican Party about to meet the day of reckoning, the day when their base realizes that they've been lied to about defunding Obamacare. Lightning strikes a worker at the Creation Museum in Kentucky. I don't think I need to say anything else about that. Tom Coburn, we're almost there, folks. Impeachment's coming. And in addition to some stories about gun control, just an amazing story about ESPN, the NFL, and Frontline. We will get to all that in just a moment. But before we do that, of course, folks, we've got to get to Cliff Schechter, which means that I'm going to take a break. Now, just a little bit of a couple of things I want to say in terms of housekeeping. One, I want to say happy birthday to Matt. Let's see. I don't really have all the... how about this?
Fear that radical Muslims who want to control the Middle East and ultimately the world would love to see In God We Trust stricken from our money and replaced with In Muhammad We Trust.
Yeah, that's because I couldn't get to this button quick enough, Matt. But happy birthday. Matt has now officially turned... now, how old are you now, Matt? I think you're about like 17 or 18. Whatever it's legal for you to be working in the office, that seems to be the age that you are. Also want to remind you guys, so happy birthday to Matt. Also want to remind you guys that on Monday, Matt and Mike will be doing their show if Mike is available. Mike has a lot of other obligations apparently these days. And Matt and Mike will be doing Matt and Mike Mondays, and then we will be off for a week. We have a mixture of some new material and some archived material for you. Members get a couple other bonus materials during the week, and we will be back the day after Labor Day. Good time to tell you folks that we really need your support for members. We hear mixed things on the supposedly the recovery of the economy, and frankly, from our perspective, a lot of our members are hurting. So, which causes them to be able to basically to stop until they can find a job. So if you can afford to support this program, please do at majority.fm. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the wonderful Cliff Schechter.
If I saw you now, could I look in your eyes?
Folks, Sam Cedar back on the Majority Report. It is Casual Friday. You know what that means. We have the wonderful Cliff Schechter with us. But before we get to the wonderful Cliff Schechter, we need to get to the wonderful Cliff Schechter's theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. If you want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
That's right, Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com. Now, Cliff, I don't think you could hear your theme song today, could you?
I couldn't, and really because of that, I'll probably be in a much worse mood the entire day.
Well, I apologize for that. Maybe we can rig up something by the end of this that so that you can. But I'll do apologies. I hope everything else is good.
I appreciate that, Sam.
I hope everything else is doing good.
Everything else is great, man.
All right.
Yeah, everything else is great. How about with you? You upstate picking some strawberries or something?
Well, not strawberries. It's strawberry season is past. It is now raspberry. Raspberry season. If you sow your raspberries properly, in other words, you cut them to the proper length in spring, you can get a harvest basically that starts a month ago and runs basically for another 3 weeks. Just a little tip for people.
No, I'm learning stuff from you, so I appreciate it.
All right. Well, Matt's asking me to sing the theme song to you, but let's just Cliff Schechter. Libertas LLC. That's
wow.
There you go.
From the days of Sam the Entertainer, we like. It's a good throwback.
Yes. All right. Now, Cliff, there's a lot of things. Frankly, I mean, we will trade a couple of emails leading up to our Friday segments as to what we're going to talk about. We seem to have kept adding things. But there's
the segment today, folks, is going to be 3 hours and 45 minutes.
Well, I mean, we could, and frankly, I think people would love it,
yeah.
But I would get in trouble.
Friday, we'll see.
Let's,
I don't want to get you in trouble.
I want to talk to you about the Manning situation. I want to talk to you about this bizarre story coming out of surrounding the NSA revelations, including, I mean, there was a lot that went on this week, including Glenn Greenwald's partner, who was working with him, at least in terms of a courier, I guess, at the behest of the Guardian, between him and Poitras, was stopped and detained for 9 hours. There's a couple of gun control and just sort of ridiculous sort of gun narratives that are going on around there. But there's this story about that broke today about ESPN, the NFL, and Frontline that I think is really I think it's worth us talking about. Apparently, Frontline, which I think people are familiar with, is a show on PBS. It's a great sort of documentary series. And they had been working with ESPN over the past year and a half on a series about the damages that football, essentially playing football in the NFL, does to one's brain. And there are 4,000, I think, NFL families that are suing the NFL, I believe, at this point. There's a legal dispute in federal court for more than 4,000 players and their wives who have charged the league concealed for years and even decades what it knew about the long-term dangers of repeated hits to the head. So apparently, after a preview of this Frontline documentary, which ESPN had partnered with, aired about a month ago at what they call the Upfronts, that's where network hype, apparently, according to the story in the New York Times, the NFL sat down with ESPN officials, and now ESPN is backed out.
Yeah, I mean, this is really an amazing story. I guess it is. You know, there's so many things involved in this story, obviously, that go beyond just what's going on with the NFL. There's media consolidation, which is so often a part of the story, and other things. But really, it's disturbing because more has been coming out, you know, in recent years. I mean, look, football players are getting bigger and bigger.
All right, hold on one second, Cliff. Hold on. I apologize. We lost a bit of the audio for people, so let me just catch them up a little bit. It is on the video, so we'll be able to pull this for the podcast. But we of the many stories that we were talking about over the course of the week, we were talking about this NFL story. Okay, all right. Well, let's just go forward, Cliff, with the audio. I mean, I'm sorry. We're talking about this NFL story. Just give me your take on it. I mean, we have sort of a fascinating story that talks about the real problems with media concentration.
Yep. I mean, to me, that seems like a huge part of this because obviously you've got Frontline doing this project. ESPN, of course, is pays an amount of money, a large sum of money, to be able to broadcast the NFL Monday night game. And so Disney, of course, who owns ESPN doesn't want to lose these rights. So ESPN is pressured, it seems, to stop working on this story, even though there's been explosive information coming out about the relationship between, you know, hard hits and brain trauma. This becomes like a political story because it's the kind of thing you and I are used to hearing. I mean, it reminds you of something like if people saw the movie The Insider, reminds you of the Koch brothers getting a documentary killed at PBS. This is sort of in that vein.
Yeah, indeed. And, you know, what's really sort of strange about all this, too, is that this Frontline documentary now is guaranteed to probably be the most successful Frontline documentary in years, right? I mean, it's not like they've killed the project. It's just that ESPN has pulled out from it after it's practically already done.
Right, and in the end, and great, this is great, by the way, perfect, I can now hear you really well, so
okay,
sorry
good.
For before if I was jumping in at the wrong time. Because look, in the end, as Al Franken learned when Fox News sued him over his book, and it shot to number one, there's nothing like getting a ton of press from something like this happening. I mean, all that's going to happen in the end is this documentary is going to benefit from this, because look, you and I are now talking about this. And frankly, this is an issue that I'm interested in following, and I wasn't even aware that this documentary was in production. Now I know all about it.
Yeah.
As do your listeners, who may not have known about it either, and I'm sure in many other places. So it's not going to stop it from happening. I don't understand this quite often when these guys do this. I'm not sure Disney knows what the, you know, understands what they think they're accomplishing by doing this, but they're giving it more press is what they're doing.
Now, yeah, I mean, that's the thing that people should understand, too, is that ESPN is owned by Disney, and it was the Disney
right.
officials. I mean, no, I mean, it was ESPN's owned by Disney. Disney also owns ABC, and ESPN and ABC both have a relationship with the NFL. I mean, I think ESPN
it's like Sunday night and Monday night football, if I'm correct, right?
That's right.
I mean, they change channels enough that...
That's right.
I could be wrong, but I know ESPN does one of them, either Sunday night or Monday night, and they pay a good sum of money to do it because they benefit largely from being associated with it, and they don't want the NFL to pull it away from them.
They pay the NFL a billion. They pay the NFL $1 billion a year. $1 billion a year for that, and yet, even though they're paying the NFL $1 billion a year, they still are worried about losing, apparently, their relationship with them.
Well, they've got competitors, Fox Sports and others, and ESPN doesn't want to risk that they'll lose, their branding. They're still considered sort of the top sports channel. I don't think they want to take a chance on losing that.
Do you get the sense that that the NFL may not actually be a sport in 20 years?
Yes, I do. I never thought, even as recently as a couple of years ago, that I'd be saying something like that. But at this point, we're really at the point now that you're at. Again, I brought up the insider before that we were at when I don't want to pick a year, but where we know that tobacco is causing cancer, and it's a matter of how much information can be suppressed before that comes out, or global warming, or gun violence, or really any of the other topics we talk about here, where the relevant industry tries to suppress information so that they can, even if their revenues slow down because some of the money, the information's gotten out there, they can still keep going. And at this point, obviously, football is hugely, it's still enormously popular. It's it's part of American tradition, but it's clearer and clearer. What's going on here that these guys are, with the suicides, high-profile players like Junior Seau, some of these guys purposely shooting themselves in the chest and leaving notes and saying, I didn't want to shoot myself in the head because I want my brain to be examined to help others in the future, that it's causing unbelievable depression in these guys after they retire. I mean, some of it's coming out of hockey, some of it's coming out of boxing, but we know this is there, and the NFL has obviously has a large number of enormous players slamming into each other again and again and again in these games and causing these concussions. There is going to be a point where I think society is going to have to question what we can do. We put pads on these guys. We put helmets on these guys. At what point do you just, is it just there's not really anything else you can do because 350 to 450-pound human beings weren't meant to be running into each other at full speed, 100 times a game.
Yeah, I mean it's very hard to imagine football going away, but I mean I don't know what can be done to mitigate this, right? I mean I guess it's just sort of maybe they change the rules of what happens at the on the lines. I have no idea, but clearly it's a problem that the NFL is certainly concerned about. Now I also wonder that when the ESPN, and apparently it was leaked by officials at ESPN, was invited to a lunch meeting with NFL footballs. It was a table for four, writes the New York Times. Roger Goodell, Commissioner of the NFL, Steve Borenstein, President of the NFL Network, ESPN's President John Skipper, and John Wildhack, ESPN's Executive Vice President for Production. Apparently, the league officials expressed that they were pissed about this, and then ESPN subsequently pulls out. It certainly seems to me that this is not going to go over very well in the course of that case that's winding its way through federal courts, claiming that the NFL has suppressed information that that head injuries and the, knowing about the long-term dangers, essentially, from, you know, 200-300-pound guys banging their heads together. This seems to me to be another example of them trying to suppress this information.
Yeah, I mean, that's clear. Look, you're right. They've got this important case winding its way through the courts, I don't know how this makes the NFL look better in this situation. You would think that this documentary gets done no matter what. So why would you just make your role look more nefarious in trying to suppress this information? I don't get it, but, you know, at the same time, as I was sort of trying to tie this into other things we talk about, this seems to be the story of every big industry.
Yeah.
So they all seem to have similar mindsets that somehow, not to mention governments, right, somehow they can stop information from coming out that in most cases ends up coming out. And in this case, you know, there's too much of a there. I mean, there's too much evidence of what's going on right now. So I don't know how they think they're bettering the situation by behaving this way, but I don't understand a lot of things that Roger Goodell does. So,
all right, well, let
why
me.
Should this be any different? Right?
You've led us into a segue about things not coming out. I want to touch on this NSA thing just briefly. I'll talk more about it as the show progresses. But it's really, really strange in some way. We had a story that was released this morning by the UK Independent saying exclusive and reporting that the United Kingdom, the Brits, have a Mideast internet surveillance base that essentially taps fiber optic cables that are underwater and can extract information from them. It intercepts and processes vast quantities of emails, telephone calls, and web traffic on behalf of Western intelligence agencies. Now, this is a situation where we're talking about surveillance on other countries. And people can take issue with that, but this isn't something that I perceive as whistleblowing. This is not, I think we're quite clear that we spy on other countries and whatnot. And same probably goes for the Brits, and probably same goes for every other country. So this is one of those leaks that one could make a very strong argument is not about whistleblowing, but harms national security. According to the UK Independent, it's not revealing the precise location of the station, but information on its activities was contained in the leaked documents obtained from the NSA by Edward Snowden. Okay, now the wording's really important here because it doesn't say they got it from there. The Guardian newspaper's reporting on these documents in recent months has sparked a dispute with the government, with the GCHQ, that's the Government Communications Headquarters, security experts overseeing the destruction of hard drives containing data. Weird two things to sort of put together in one paragraph. The disclosure comes as the Metropolitan Police announced it was launching a terrorist investigation into material found on the computer of David Miranda. This is Glenn Greenwald's partner. They also go on to say that the Guardian agreed to the government's request not to publish any material contained in the Snowden documents that could damage national security. So this is a very strange, and as soon as I saw this, it was actually posted last night, our time, it struck me as weird. Glenn Greenwald has come out with a piece today saying that Edward Snowden released a statement. The statement says, I have never given information to the UK Independent. I have never spoken with or provided journalistic material to them. The journalists I've worked with at my request have been judicious and careful in ensuring that the only the things that are what the public should know, but does not place any person in danger. It seems, and Glenn Greenwald seems to be charging, that the Independent was basically carrying water for the government, the British government, because the British government wanted to leak something and make it seem like it was a Snowden leak that in some way jeopardized national security. What do you make of this, Cliff?
Yeah. I make of this, we need to make a James Bond movie about everything going on in this case. I wish I had a more informed opinion of what to make of this. Obviously, Snowden is claiming he didn't leak anything to the Independent. The Independent's not claiming that it was leaked to them from Snowden. Now there's sort of, I guess, an update. I'm looking here, and where they're claiming that you know, they're denying that they were leaked anything or duped in any way to publishing something that would help the government. But obviously, something's going on here. You know, let's just say it's very suspicious.
And apparently,
I don't know what else.
Well, public opinion in Britain is apparently it seems to, at least, you know, sort of from an anecdotal, I haven't seen any polls, but apparently people are quite upset about Miranda's detention because it is a law that is presumably about protecting Britain from terrorism, and it's a real big stretch to say that in any way detaining this guy for as long as they did, that this was based on terrorism. I mean, you know, what appears to me on some level is that the NSA has no idea what Snowden has, and they are now sort of. There's all sorts of sort of craziness going on to try and either hide that fact or to find out and smoke out what Snowden has.
Oh, I'm sorry, I lost you again in that last period. There's Glenn.
I was saying that it's clear that the NSA doesn't seem to have any idea of what Snowden has.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. Which is, I guess, why we keep going through this entire. This exercise, they don't seem to know at all. I mean, that sort of is an argument for why the British government stopped Glenn's partner to look through and try to get a better idea of what he had. And if I'm repeating anything you said, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Again, because it cut out on me. I mean, yeah, they don't seem to be able to know there. I mean, I guess there's sort of in a number of instances, it sort of seems like they're doing what they can to sort of thrash around and figure out what exactly it is that this guy has, which I would think that they could ascertain from what he had access to. But you know, that's one thing that stopping Dave and Glenn's partner in London tells me is that they were looking for these items. You know, I mean, there's other people that have obviously had other theories as to why they're doing it. I think somebody even tweeted out that they, you know, I'm trying to think, I think it was Ian Bremmer, who's sort of an internationally connected guy, that they were trying to build a case against Glenn and David with it, as in a criminal case. I have no idea whether, you know, that's accurate or not. I'm just throwing that out there. But to me, it seems that there's a very good chance that what it is they're just trying to figure out what exactly do these guys have. You know, and I mean, right, Laura Poitras is putting together a film, and Glenn is continuing to sort of write his stories. And so, you know, they're expecting, you know, the drumbeat continues. And frankly, this, you know, whatever, this has been done in a smart way, because you do one big dump of documents and people tend to miss a lot. Whereas what these guys have done, obviously, is over a number of months, I guess, you know, maybe not a number of months now. I don't know how long, it's been 2 months or so, but they've been releasing a little at a time.
Right. And I think they're looking, you know, I mean, they're still looking through this stuff, but here's what's really, I think, you know, most problematic from my perspective. And that is, if the NSA doesn't know what Edward Snowden took, what kind of control do they have on this information? I mean, I was making this point yesterday, but, you know, they know Edward Snowden took stuff because Edward Snowden made it very public that he took stuff. But what if Edward Snowden had not made it public that he took stuff? What if he wanted to sell this information to the Brits or to the Russians or the Chinese? It doesn't appear that the NSA would have any clue as to that he had done that.
No, I know. I mean, that's disturbing as it is, which is just that also, as we know, you know, he's a contractor. He wasn't somebody who was within the government. He was a Booz Allen contractor. So, you know, what other guys that are defense contractors that can get this kind of information, you won't know. To me, that's always been one of the biggest facts that makes this case so important, which is, you know, it's not just the information. I mean, the NSA, the sort of the arguments are always, well, you know, we've got good controls on the information. People wouldn't be able to just go out. You know, we don't use it. We won't take certain information without a warrant, particularly specifics of beyond the metadata and the rest. But, you know, if somebody like that can get access to it, and he hadn't been with Booz for very long, then the question is, you know, what about people that do intend to sell it to China and Russia and really a variety of other people?
Yeah, and it doesn't appear
that's kind of worrisome, isn't it?
Yeah, and it doesn't appear that the NSA has any ability to be aware of whether or not that's actually happened. Because if they can't track where he's been when they know that he's stolen stuff, how could they possibly track stuff that they don't know has been stolen? You know what I mean? I mean, this seems really, really problematic. But let's also...
I think you've got a better home security system than they've got.
I do. I mean, at least, you know, like I take an inventory. But that's also...
You'd know if something was going down.
You know, that's also the problem with... That's also the other aspect of this, that I just don't think that in many respects, we as a society and that the national security establishment has not caught up to. That is that fundamentally, digital secrets are fundamentally different. You can talk all you want about how much you want to maintain secrecy, but when things are digital, it's a very different ball game. They wheeled in the Pentagon Papers into the New York Times in a couple of shopping carts. And now, you know, you couldn't, you could not release that by accident. It would be very difficult to, you know, it would be impossible to release it by accident. Like, oh, we just sent 75 pounds of papers to you by mistake. But now it's just a click of the mouse.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously that's changed everything as it has for us. It's much harder to keep a hold. I mean, I'm just imagining what you're talking about, the printing up and sort of loading up of those documents with the Pentagon Papers and just the situation and how different it is today. It's you know, it's amazing, and obviously it's changed the way we do everything, but it's made some things easier, but it also has made all sorts of information. You know, it's made it a lot easier for anybody from your hacker to corporations to others to steal information from any of us. That's kind of what we live with having the added convenience and productivity of the rest of the online world. And so obviously the NSA is dealing with the same thing, and have they caught up and developed protocols to protect themselves from this kind of thing? I mean, the Snowden thing makes you wonder, you know, I mean, and why is it that I had to learn from the Huffington Post that Ben Affleck was going to be the next Batman? Shouldn't the NSA have had that first?
Well, indeed, but
I couldn't help myself. So
I know, I understand, but no. But the other issue is that, of course, when you steal this information, all you're doing is copying it. You're not necessarily taking it,
right?
And that's why the NSA.
No, right. Totally different. Yeah.
Totally different situation, and it's, you know, the ease in which you copy these things. I don't know. I think it's fascinating. I mean, you know, that brings up, like, you know, the idea of the British government smashing the hard drives of the Guardian. Big deal. You've basically just, you know, they got to spend another whatever it is, $4,000 on a couple of new computers. It's a fascinating.
I mean, you probably have things saved in like 14 different places.
Of course. And there doesn't seem to be a recognition of that. And
I'm going to break your floppy disk kind of thing. Isn't that scary?
Indeed. I mean, it seems ludicrous to me. Let's touch briefly also on Chelsea Manning, nay Bradley Manning is the way that I'm referring to her now, just so that, you know, people until we make that transition that she is making. For those who are not aware of it, I think most people are at this point, but Bradley Manning announced on the day after he was found or sentenced, I should say, that he was going to begin the process of a transgender process and wanted to be referred to as she. And we are respecting her requests here. And her name is now Chelsea Manning. And yep. That, to me, seems, you know, rather secondary. It is sort of overtaken the real injustice, I think, that she is being subjected to, because, frankly, 35 years seems to me to be completely out of bounds, particularly when you compare it to what actual spies have received.
Right. Well, that's my biggest, I mean, you know, all this stuff I've always said from the beginning I find complicated because, you know, the point I was making was obviously 35 years, when you look at the fact that some, you know, that sure, there were documents that were released that were classified that then Bradley Manning released. But also, again, so, you know, maybe a hard call. We may call someone a traitor who goes and releases secrets, you know, that are key secrets of the government or that kind of thing. But when it's things that are being done that are wrong in our name, obviously, when it's things that are being done that frankly lead to murder in our name, then, you know, this is kind of important stuff. And what some we were doing in Iraq and Afghanistan, there were some important things in there, video and others, if people have seen it, that's horrifying. And so, obviously, it's a judgment call with any of this stuff, but the judgment call has to be here. I would hope that, you know, that even though that these were classified secrets, there was a positive good to their being released.
Yeah.
And so when you balance that versus, you know, Dick Cheney and you and, you know, Addington, you know, and the torturers and others who are still allowed to exist in public life as opposed to having ever been held accountable for their actions. When you look at you know, what went on Wall Street and the fact that nobody, for the most part, except for a Bernie Madoff here and there, was ever held accountable for those actions. I mean, that's what makes this whole thing so ridiculous. I mean, it's sort of like you just sort of sit here. You just, you know, the democracy is sort of based on justice. You know, it's based on the principle of, you know, where you're of laws and not of men or women for that matter, and that that laws are applied equally. And it's just quite clear that they're not here.
Yeah,
it's not even close.
No, I agree. And, you know, we're talking about information that 1.5 million people had access to. We're talking about information where the prosecution never even made any type of assertion that anyone died because this information was released. In other words, there was no assets that were compromised. There was no specific claim of harming of national security. It came down to it embarrassed the U.S. government in some respects because, you know, all of a sudden we all knew that they were lobbying to suppress the Haitian minimum wage, or that they were lobbying against foreign governments having the opportunity to prosecute torturers from the United States. I mean, et cetera, et cetera. So it really is, in many respects, a miscarriage of justice, not to mention the near torture Manning herself was subject to while she was at Quantico.
By the naked, you know, having to sleep naked and what is it? Was it 23 hours of solitary? I mean, I may be getting even some of that wrong, maybe worse. But, I mean, You know, even when that was going on, that's not the way we're supposed to be treating people in this country.
Right.
The holdover of what happened to us during the Bush years. And it's not to say that we've never done this kind of thing before and in our past, but we're supposed to be better than that. And we're supposed to be beyond that, you know, that kind of injustice and that kind of vengefulness. If we're supposed to be sort of this democracy, it's supposed to be a beacon of light that people hold up to want to emulate around the world. And it just, again and again, you just sort of say, you know, how is that possible with these kinds of things? You know, how is that possible? And I mean, obviously, that's the sort of looking at it from a macro point of view. But from a micro point of view, we tortured an individual. I mean, call it whatever you want, but that seemed to me solitary for those kinds of hours and sort of the humiliation of being naked and the rest of that. You know, I've worked with a coalition in the past a couple of years ago that was trying to prevent sort of prison rape, you know, and so I saw a lot of what was going on beyond just rape in our prisons and going on from prison guards and going on, you know, from wardens. Harassment, humiliation, and whatever, and it's sort of it sickens you when you see it. You know, if you believe in what we believe in, what you hope we all believe in, it sickens you when you see it. And just every, you know, and so this is sort of along those lines, you know. And it just, I don't know, I don't know how you can be an American and wake up and sort of believe in the ideals of this country and not have this bother you.
And we should say, you know, Daniel Ellsberg was his case was never fully adjudicated. It was a mistrial because of government malfeasance. And so that's
right.
Why Daniel Ellsberg is walking around today. All right, let's.
They broke into his psychiatrist's office,
yeah.
Which they didn't even need to do. I mean, that was sort of the hallmark of the Nixon folks,
yeah.
Doing things they didn't need to do and then getting into trouble for them.
Indeed. All right. Well, we don't have too much time left, but I want to talk about a couple of these of what's going on with guns in this country, and particularly apparently the right wing is. Tell me about this story about Lane, because I have not followed it, to be honest with you.
Yeah. No, it's all right. I mean, and you know, and it's a good segue from where we were, because we were discussing how, you know, at least I was brought up how we want to be viewed by the world. And now there are people in Australia that are calling for a boycott of this country because of the level of gun violence here. And I, you know, I see that probably only getting worse in the future, because it's not like we're one of many. We are unique among civilized countries that has this problem. This just doesn't happen anywhere else because they actually do crazy stuff like regulate guns. And in this case, Chris Lane, who's studying on a scholarship in Oklahoma, is a great baseball player. He wanted to play baseball. Australian from Melbourne, and he happened to be jogging, and a couple teens. Saw him and apparently were bored and were vicious and had access to guns, because we believe everyone should have access to guns in this country, and they shot him and killed him. And the right wing, of course, as always, gets the entirely wrong lesson from something like that. Their lesson is, a bunch of black guys shot a white guy because, you know, two of the three perpetrators were African American. Of course, one of them was white, which they conveniently forget, as they conveniently forget many things. But the media is not reporting this. This is supposed to be sort of the equivalent of, look at how they reported on the Trayvon case, but they won't report on this. Meanwhile, there's been plenty of reporting on this, and the reason why people haven't been making it, you know, this a similarity to the Trayvon Martin case is because there is no similarity. Because in that case, somebody shot an African-American youth and wasn't even arrested. That is why it became a big story.
Right.
Otherwise, it would have just been another one of the many random shootings in this country that we deal with every day.
Right.
It became a story because this guy did not even get arrested because of an unbelievably idiotic law in Florida that allows essentially racists to walk around and do this kind of thing. Because if you look at the statistics, you know, the vast majority, something like 88% of the cases, I guess, or whatever it was, it's whites shooting blacks and using stand your ground. In this case, two black youth and another white youth, went and killed this guy, Chris Lane. It's an unbelievable tragedy. They are obviously vicious individuals who should be prosecuted to the full extent of the law and should never see the light. I mean, I guess they're under the age of 18, I think, so I don't know what that is. But how the hell is it that they have guns?
Right.
How is it that guys like that just sitting around have guns? That's because all the people, the Bill O'Reillys and the Michelle Malkins and the people who are screaming about this and trying to turn this into a racial issue, which it isn't, that's the reason why guys like this have guns, because they won't allow basic background checks, because they won't allow any kind of regulation. People, when guns are lost and stolen, a bunch of states have passed laws to track that. They won't allow federal law to do that. I can go on and on, but there's so many ways you could stop kids like this from getting guns. We don't try
Of the NRA. The bottom
NRA
line
is a front for arms dealers.
We know the bottom line exactly. The bottom line, the reason why these kids have guns is because people make money off of them having guns. That's
of course.
Everything else falls in line, and emanates from that. You know, it's interesting because,
Everything else is just bullshit and noise.
Right.
Is really all the rest of it is. It's just a way – anything they say is a message point to allow more guns to be sold to more people, because that's where the profit is. And I know we have to jump in a second, but I wanted to make sure to bring up the other thing that went on, this week, important in this case, which was this near-school shooting in Georgia.
Yeah.
Where this unbelievable woman, her last name is Tough, I'm trying to remember her first name, if it's Rebecca or something, who is a bookkeeper there, when this kid walked in and announced his intention, which I'm going to tell you that most of the time these killers, who are people who are about to kill people are not going to do, but thankfully in this case, announced his intention to kill people because he wanted to end his life, had an assault weapon. She was able to sit him down, talk to him, in a way that, almost, if you know what hostage negotiators do, is reminiscent of that. I don't know if she had any training or she just is a very smart woman, but basically talked this guy down by telling her about all the difficult things going on in her life, not acting like a victim, being very sort of straightforward. In other words, telling her about her life, but being very straightforward, that he could have a future and the rest. And in the end, after he shot the police a few times and gave himself up, but, the right-wing response to this, again, is we need guns in schools. That's the response.
Right.
The response isn't, look at how she was able to do this, as if it's easier to get a smart, well-trained bookkeeper who can do this kind of thing in every single school in the country than it is to – it's easier to do that than it is to prevent people from showing up who are mentally unbalanced with assault weapons. And the key sort of coda to this story, beyond the fact that somehow this kid had access to an assault weapon, is that he'd stopped taking his drugs, guess why? Because he had lost his Medicaid. That's why. So remember that when every right-wing governor who under Obamacare refuses Medicaid for the people in their country, in their state, because freedom or something.
Freedom means being able to get as much guns as you want and as little medicine as possible. I mean, I guess that's basically the formula,
exactly.
Right? You don't have the freedom to get health care.
Kind of risk.
Just to have a weapon. I've heard the audio of that. She was on the phone with 911 while she was basically talking this guy down. He had apparently, fired some shots in the air. She talked him down. It was really impressive. But, again, yes, there's a problem that we just obviously this guy didn't have any problem getting any guns. But he had more problems getting medication,
that, which we chose not to regulate yet again.
It's stunning. Well,
right?
Cliff,
it is. Go ahead, sorry.
I'm sorry. No, my apologies. And I apologize for the technical difficulties today. Going on vacation next week. So you will have vacation. We'll see you after Labor Day. And then, of course, in the fall, we're going to see basically either a debt ceiling fight or a government shutdown. It looks like it's going to be a debt ceiling fight. Just briefly to touch on it, because this is going to end up being the story as we move into September. The Republicans have been going around. The right wingers have been going around basically saying that they're going to shut down Obamacare and they're going to use the debt ceiling as leverage. But they're lying to their base. And it's going to be interesting. Quickly, do you think that they're going to pay any price? I mean, this could hurt them in 2014. Yes.
It could, and it should. I think it really depends on what the Democratic side of the equation looks like, and if we get, unlike 2 years ago, we get some strong progressive candidates running in some of these key swing districts, of which there are a number, And, you know, for some reason, the DCCC doesn't seem to be recruiting people for them, which is another conversation another time. But if we have the right people in the right place, and these guys do, you know, do this debt, this fight over the debt ceiling and hurt the United States, the credit of the United States, I think there's a serious price they would pay. Yes.
All right. Cliff, once again, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon, buddy.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Sam.
Hi, Cliff. All right. We're going to take a break, folks, and we'll be back in just a minute with Matthew Film Guy. Folks.
Okay, I'm here.
Okay, folks. I don't know if Matthew can hear me. I hope he can. Hold on for 1 second. Matthew, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Sam.
All right, good. That is the first thing that has worked well today. Bear with me, folks. Again, a little bit of technical difficulties, not the least of which one of those technicalities is that my daughter does not seem to understand the concept of Daddy's doing a show. Don't bother Daddy. So that's a little bit of, Matthew, I don't think I have your music, so we're going to have to do this, buddy.
Today is casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She going
really?
To recommend
yeah.
A movie
Sorry, buddy.
Or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know. Listen to the picks from it.
Mike Matthew Weiss.
GillisGillies.com.
I mean, MatthewFilmGuy.com. Hello, Matthew. Sorry about that, buddy.
That's okay, Sam. Anything for a laugh, I suppose.
Now, Matthew, I got a little bit of a beef with you. Last week, or not
yeah.
last week, but the last time you were on, you recommended a Mike Leigh film, Meantime. Is that right? Do I have that correct?
You have that absolutely correct, Sam. Did you watch it?
I didn't, because it's not streaming anywhere. It's not on Amazon, it's not on Netflix, it's not on iTunes.
Well, if you were listening to my segment last week, you'd know that it's streaming on YouTube.
On YouTube?
Yeah.
I guess I didn't.
I mentioned that. I could forgive you for not paying attention.
I didn't pick that up. Well, why would they put it on YouTube and not these other and not these other services?
You know, I don't know. I think Mike Lee and his collected works that he made for the BBC has yet to negotiate full streaming rights. Some of his later movies are on the other services, but it's come down to fans to put it up on YouTube and other places. And it is available, but it's not an optimal way of watching a film. I grant you that. But I thought the film was so prescient, given what we're going through, and so deep and so valuable that I went ahead and recommended it to you and your audience.
Yeah, well, okay. I forgot about the YouTube thing, and Michael didn't put it in the in the breakdown of the show, and so I couldn't find it. I spent an hour finding it. What I did find, however, was a piece by Ray Carney from the films of Mike Lee about the movie. And so I ended up just reading that piece, which I thought was interesting.
Oh, yeah, it's very interesting. In fact, Ray Carney's book on Mike Lee is something that extremely excited me about the films of Mike Lee. Having only seen his later ones, Naked and Secrets and Lies and some of the bigger ones, reading that book inspired me to go back through and watch all his BBC films, which are all uniformly great.
Well, let's talk about Ray Carney for a second, because you know, I think we've mentioned him in the past on the program, but not in a while. I mean, that's how you and I know each other. Tell people who Ray Carney
that's
is.
That's right. Ray Carney is a film scholar and film professor who's written extensively, primarily on the films of John Cassavetes, but also has written books on Frank Capra, Mike Lee, Carl Dreyer, and other artists, independent film artists, and for a while there in the late 90s, early 2000s, he was the huge champion for low-budget, underseen, but criminally neglected independent filmmakers, one of which you were at a certain point, and that's when he knew me as a kind of up-and-coming film guy wanting to connect with other filmmakers, and he suggested that I come to help you, and, you know, he's right about a lot of things otherwise. But
wait, what do you mean otherwise?
Recently, he's gotten a lot of notoriety. It was what it was. Let's just put it that way.
Ray Carney invited me to show Who's the Caboose at BU to his film school, and then he passed me. He basically, when I was looking for people to help me with another movie I was doing, he sent me. You were one of the people he sent me, and it was also Big Mike too, who worked on A Bad Situation. This came from Ray Carney, but what you know, he's also aside from not necessarily being able to assess different people's talent at different times, but he is also
right.
He has a very radical. Well, I don't know if radical is the right word, but. He has a very distinct perspective on film, and often tells his students that they should leave film school, which doesn't really put him in good stead with the dean of the school, does it?
No, he's entered into right now what I basically consider his like late Lenny Bruce period, where unfortunately the last about 10 years he's been in a heated battle with his university over the direction that their film program is gone. Namely into a sort of Hollywood commercialized and attempt to get a lot of money in these kind of, you know, these programs that just make these students into customers and want to tell them anything that they want to hear and kind of cater to whatever will make them the most money. And, of course, Ray is this bastion of the liberal arts and film as an art form, and he has run into a lot of political issues with his school and to the point where they've tried to get him fired. He has tenure. And he's written polemic after polemic about the attempts of BU to smear him, to threaten him, and I have sympathy for him, but it's, well, let's just say it's an extremely anxiety-producing situation for anybody to be in, let alone to read about, and It's you can go to his website and see the long and short of it, but it's a lot about academic freedom that he talks about, and it does get a little bit into those scenes like how Lenny Bruce would just go on stage and read his court transcript. You're with him, but it's reached a point where you're kind of like, okay, man, let's get back to why we're talking about this, which is film, and unfortunately he hasn't written a lot about film that's made it out there, possibly due to his persecution by his university, in quite some time.
Yeah, that's sad. But let's turn to, he's got. I want to read some of what he wrote about Meantime, because the introduction itself is, I think, you know, sort of is fascinating. It doesn't have anything specifically to do with Meantime, but he writes that many writers about film have a mistaken notion of art. They think it presents experiences packed with tight, compressed meaningfulness. Just sitting there waiting to be unpacked by the diligent critic. In the standard critical demonstrations, the greatness of Citizen Kane, Vertigo, 2001, is that virtually every lighting effect, camera angle, or prop is freighted with interlocking significance. Criticism is the act of translating those stylistic details into an intricate series of significations. The critic exhumes the sermons the artist has artfully hidden under his stones. In this view, both creation and interpretation are acts of mastery. Faustian enterprises in which the artist operates from a position of ultimate knowingness that the critic and viewer aspire to equal. This is a really interesting indictment of what passes for art. I mean, he goes on to say that films should not be puzzles, but they should be, they should not be hidden meanings that, need to be deciphered. But they need to be full of psychological uncertainties and emotional complexities that don't have an answer. And that's really where you're coming from, isn't it? In other words, you've
absolutely
lifted everything,
Sam,
that Carney's ever.
Yes, I am so happy that you've quoted this passage, because the intro to the Mike Leigh book stands as one of the greatest kind of philosophical statements of what an alternate vision of film could actually be, and not just to be contrarian, not just to be pretentious or whatever, but to actually give you some sort of new insight into the way the whole medium can affect you emotionally, psychologically, perceptually, and that passage does as good a job as any of summing up the basic sort of enterprise of a lot of Ray Carney's writing. And I love it. Yes, that's exactly what excited me about Ray Carney, what excited me about John Cassavetes' films, Mike Leigh's films, and some other key filmmakers who are trying to work in this sort of non-intellectual, non-abstract, non-kind of what Ray has called the decoder ring style of filmmaking. And it's just not represented almost anywhere. Even the leading critics in the major sort of newspapers or film journals all subscribe to that kind of interpretation, you know, surface depth kind of reading of film. And reading Ray Carney's books was just a mind blower for me about 20 years ago when I first got into it. But yes, that is what excites me about film in general.
It is pretty stunning that you don't ever see any type of film criticism. I imagine it must exist online, right? Because the bar to entry would be lower. But I haven't come across it where you see any type of film criticism that really does look at film from that perspective of it being experiential and not necessarily coming out with, hey, that was here I figured out the movie, essentially.
Yeah, you know, you would think so, but I don't claim to have read every single film blog out there, but I've looked and I've hoped for that kind of thinking to catch on, and in a way it just seems like the sort of commercial style of film, even in the independent film world, that kind of Citizen Kane-based filmmaking has not just won, but completely eradicated any kind of alternate vision. I mean, even the other critics who I like, like guys like Jonathan Rosenbaum and some other critics that are popular, they occasionally mention that, but since their job is to kind of fill column inches every month, they've turned into sort of these just like consumer advocates, just like, you're going to like this, you're not going to like this, this is going to be a good spending of your $9 or whatever or not. So I'm really not sure if there is a space anymore, given the sort of coarsening of just general culture, for this kind of take. And it's, in a way, that's why Ray has fought so hard for his sort of vision of film education, because even the universities are starting to cater to this kind of, you know, let's deconstruct the Matrix. Let's see the symbolism in, you know, the Raiders of the Lost Ark. And I'm not saying that I don't enjoy those movies, but they've become all that there is in a way, even amongst sort of serious film circles, as far as I can tell. Now, again, I may be Matthew Film Guy, but I haven't seen everything out there. And if anyone can point me to something that negates that or contradicts that, I would greatly appreciate it.
Well, we'll certainly, you know, we will accept emails on your behalf. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, the promise of the digital age, right? I mean, this was supposedly the promise of the digital age. I mean, I was just, Nikki and I were just talking last night. She was complaining that it cost $13 to get an 8-gig thumb drive that is literally the size of your thumb. And I was like, dude, when we did Who's the Caboose, 8 gigs was the size of like big VCRs, and they were incredibly expensive. The whole thing, I had to embezzle money essentially from this short video I was doing for MTV into Who's the Caboose to pay for it all by actually putting the editor and the edit bay we had built in his basement on camera and then pay him a location fee. But at that time, the promise of the digital filmmaking age, right? I mean, we were hearing all the time, I don't know who it was that said it, was it Scorsese or Coppola, or, you know, that the next great filmmaker is going to be some kid with a, you know, with a video camera. And the sort of the shocking thing is that while I was never naive enough to think that, like, this is going to create a just a crazy amount of sort of it's going to push the boundaries of film, because you don't have the same constraints, right, that you did before. You don't have the same barriers to entry. It seems to have sort of gone the opposite way. You just have people who are just sort of copying a very set formula from to tell stories. Or am I wrong? And I'm just too old and I'm not aware of what's going on.
It's a little bit of both. To be fair, there is a realm of filmmakers who are making films on their video cameras that are getting play at some of the more obscure festivals, although places like South by Southwest have recently built a greater reputation based on some of these people. But they are out there. People like, you know, like Ronnie Bronstein made a film on 16mm called Frownland. You know, Joe Swanberg is out there doing his thing, for better or worse, completely on his own terms. He's made like, I don't know, 25, 30 films in the last 10 years. People like Frank Ross, who's from Chicago, who's gotten almost no commercial distribution, but is making amazingly deep and insightful movies about people in their regular lives. He's a big favorite of mine. He had a couple films play at the MoMA as part of their kind of like unseen film festival, but he has no commercial presence. Guys like Aaron Katz, the Duplass brothers at the beginning, my friends Lawrence Levine and Sophia Takal with their movies have basically carved this niche. So there are people out there doing it. There's just not a lot of room. There's so much noise being created that the sort of signal-to-noise ratio of these kinds of movies is very high. So or low, as the case may be. So it is that way, but it's also just resulted in a glut of filmmakers who just do want to make commercial-type films with their video cameras. But it is out there.
All right.
Just not always streaming on Netflix or Amazon Prime.
All right. Well, if you say so. Well, what is there has to be. I mean, surely somebody has made a Roku app that gets these films, right? I mean, if not, why?
Well, some of these filmmakers do get their movies on Netflix and things like that. Did I recommend you a movie called The Pleasures of Being Robbed ever? And there's actually a website by a guy named Kentucker Audley who made his own independent films on his video camera in Memphis. You know, a lot of these places, people are not in New York or L.A. either. And he has a website called NoBudge.com, which is basically what it sounds like, a place for no-budget films to be streamed mostly on Vimeo. And he does this kind of interesting release strategy where he'll play it for about a week for free and then takes it down, or for a weekend and then takes it down, just on Vimeo. And it's literally just to get the audience built and to get eyes on these kinds of films. Some of them are slighter than others, but a lot of them are really amazing.
Ah, interesting. And then what? And then how does he monetize it after?
A guy named Alex Ross Perry. I don't know. I don't know if he will find a way to monetize it, but I know he's trying. He takes submissions, and you have to pay to submit his film for review. So there is some way to cover his costs. But he's in it for the art, and his original site was called notamovie.com because he used to get a lot of criticisms that the movies playing there are not real movies, quote-unquote, and it's really those kinds of not real movies that I was mostly interested in through him. So there actually is an alternate resource there if you're willing to go for it and if you're willing to watch these films, which do require a little bit more patience. They're not as satisfying on a genre level. You know, it takes a little bit of patience, a little bit of time.
All right. Well, I'd like to bring in Chris Rosen to talk about... I'm joking.
He is the epitome of those aren't real movies, believe me.
Now, just for listeners who have only joined us over the past year... Chris Rosen used to be our go-to film guy over the weekend until I realized now he's a writer for the Huffington Post. I don't know if he does reviews or he just does, it took a year and a half for me to figure out that he wasn't a movie reviewer. And I don't know why Chris came into my head as you were talking, because I probably, in terms of my sensibility, somewhere between you and Chris Rosen. Maybe a little closer to you, but probably, you know, somewhere in the middle. So with that said, Matthew.
These days we all have a Chris Rosen inside us. I mean, to be inundated with so many movies and so many different places to see them, I'm still going to see, the big budget Hollywood sci-fi movies and things like that. So,
like what?
The Chris Rosens of this world have a place.
Did you see Elysium?
Sorry? I haven't seen it yet, but that's on my list. I was a comic book fan, so I go see all the comic book movies just to kind of satiate the 15-year-old that still resides within me.
Well, dude, you don't
so,
have a problem with
again,
Ben Affleck.
I would never say that these movies need to be replaced or need to be removed. It's just when there's only cotton candy on the menu, you get a little sick to your stomach after a while. You know what I mean?
You don't have a problem with Ben Affleck being Batman, do you?
I'm not going to take to the streets with a pitchfork, but it does strike me as a little bit odd. You know, the whole, I'll reserve judgment because I enjoyed his last movie about the Iranian hostage thing.
Right,
and, you know, maybe he can pull it off. I don't know. You're not going to get me to have a too strong opinion one way or the other.
It sort of feels like
if it's Superman and Batman talking to it amongst each other, then I'll be all right.
It sort of feels like he lacks the darkness, right? That's the issue, right?
I think so. I really do think so. He's a little too jock like for Batman. I don't know what the anger is in him.
All right. Well,
but again, you know, these are we'll see. Well, it's a long way off until whatever.
In other words, who cares?
Superman,
okay,
Batman.
So. What is the movie recommendation, Matthew? I've got a week. I can't promise it. You know, I mean, now you know it's now I have two kids. Things are twice as difficult for me to watch. But what do you got for us?
Okay, well, I had two movies selected for you that I watched this week. One is a documentary, and one is one of these Hollywood indie films, which I can definitely recommend, and it's available on. Both are available on Amazon streaming.
Give them both.
One is, and I'm not sure. Sorry?
Let's hear them both.
Okay. One is a documentary called How to Make Money Selling Drugs.
Oh, yeah. I
and
see that.
It's, have you seen that yet?
No, I want to.
You know, it's a great, it's slickly done. It's got beautiful motion graphics and gorgeous HD photography, and it kind of is built around this playful video game level structure, like, you know, from like street dealer to cartel dealer. And, but it's deceptively moving and well balanced. You know, it's a take on the whole prison complex, prison industrial complex. And if it's not 100% groundbreaking, it features a lot of footage that I was shocked to see. You know, it's a kind of Vice TV genre where you're looking at films of gangs and footage of the drug war in Mexico and graphic things like that. So it's kind of got a visceral kind of element to it. But it also has some very moving interviews with people who both sold drugs, and it's these, you know, sort of real-life Walter White kind of people who just found their way into selling drugs and became giant distributors and also interviews with people who became addicted to drugs, and including a particularly moving interview with Eminem, the rapper. Wow. And he talks about his addiction to prescription pills. Wow. And I was actually pleasantly surprised by this movie. I wasn't expecting to really be as affected by it, and it was actually a really interesting documentary, which, again, if you're really up on all the issues, it probably isn't that super groundbreaking, but, you know, it shows footage of The Wire, and they interviewed David Simon, so it kind of plays as a greatest hits of all the issues that need to be addressed around the drug war, from the prisons to the courts to the politicians to the sort of street-level addiction and treating it like a crime instead of, you know, they go through the 80s and how the drug war ramped up, and I found it really well done, and like I said, pretty deceptively moving. They suck you in with a kind of, like, cool guy, like, oh, let's sell drugs kind of attitude, and sort of bring it home with the sort of dark side, the addiction and the sort of political damage done by the drug war.
All right.
So that's a good watch.
Sold it. Sold. I'm sold on that one. I will watch that one. What else?
All right. And then the other film that I watched this week, which was based on a Henry James novel. It was the indie film version of What Maisie Knew. I don't know if you ever heard of that book or read it.
No.
But the original book is basically about a young girl being caught between her narcissistic, self-absorbed parents who are getting a divorce and kind of using her as sort of a bargaining chip. And she overhears and sees things that a six-year-old girl, or I think she's six or seven, should never hear. And this version, it sort of updates it, puts it into Tribeca, and Steve Coogan and Julianne Moore, two actors who I greatly admire, play the roles of the narcissistic parents. And the movie is actually pretty well done. It's, for a movie about a young kid, it shies away from a lot of the sort of heartstring-pulling, maudlin kind of game-playing that it could have delved into. And even though it does have some kind of fantastical elements, namely that, you know, everybody lives in Tribeca lofts and the sort of the financial side of their lives are sort of only glossed over. But I found it really complicated, and actually as a child of divorce, which I know you are too, I found it very harrowing and kind of blood-boiling at certain times, and made me very uncomfortable, and for that I give it a lot of credit.
All right.
And it's a great watch.
Two winners. Good job, Matthew, film guy. I think
thank
both
you very
those
much.
Those are good. Particularly, you know, we started off on extremely pretentious and arty grounds, and I think we finished up with two. Maybe they just feel those films feel accessible after our conversation.
Yeah, you know, that's one of the issues that I run into with doing this segment. Is I'd love to be able to point you towards some of those more kind of off the beaten path, a little bit more original kind of films, but they're just not as easy to find. And if it's, you know, under the guise of the Netflix and Amazon streaming thing only, it kind of curtails what I can give you. But I definitely wanted to use this segment ever since we started it to at least address the possibility that there does exist a sort of other movies that are out there that are worth looking for, just in the way that we're looking for, you know, an alternate politics and an alternate kind of media. This side of film does actually bode well for I don't know, I think rounding out such a person's worldview and take on just on life in general that can inform your politics and can inform your personal relationships. So I will try to find other movies that fit that criteria, but are also engaging and not at all a pretentious kind of strolling among the masterpieces kind of bullcrap.
Well, I'm glad that we finally got that conversation over with. Thank you.
Thank you, Sam.
All right. Matthew Film Guy, ladies and gentlemen. Matthew Film Guy, thank you so much for joining us. All right, folks.
Bye.
We'll head into the better half. We'll do a Freebie Friday today just so that... because I think Matt and Michael have a lot of cutting to do anyways. 646-257-3920 is the number. Just a reminder, we're going to have the app will be released in about a little bit less than about 2 weeks, maybe a little bit more. And it's going to be available to everybody for free. You're going to be able to, if you're a member, you're going to be able to get all sorts of, you're going to be able to download all sorts of the shows, whatnot. If you want to call us right now, 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. And we will post a link to that Ray Carney, the Ray Carney piece, or I guess it is a piece from his book on the films of Mike Lee, Embracing the World, excerpts from a discussion of Mean Time. Michael will Google that, excerpts from a discussion on Mean Time, and then he will post the link on the site. This is a wonderful story that we didn't get to with Cliff, but we were talking about Cliff, obviously, very interested in issues about guns. This is coming from the Columbia Dispatch. I think we spoke of this story that took place a couple of weeks ago. Certified firearms instructor Terry J. Dunlap was teaching a concealed carry firearm course earlier in the month. His .38 caliber handgun discharged. The bullet ricocheted off a desk and into the arm of a student, Michael Piemonte. Now, apparently, Dunlap, who is 73, was not aware that his gun was loaded at the time that he was teaching this gun safety course. Well, it's now come out that Dunlap, this is not the first time this has happened to Dunlap. Apparently, 36 years ago, Dunlap, who was a Pickerington Police Department auxiliary lieutenant, I guess from Pickerington, Ohio, fired his .38 caliber handgun into the air to create a scary effect for his daughter at a haunted hayride. And the bullet ricocheted and hit 14-year-old Kathy Hessler in the leg. Apparently, when Hessler, now Kathy Schmetzler, 50, was told the dispatch by the dispatch that he had done it again, she said, "Oh, no, he's done it again." How many times does a guy teaching firearm safety have to accidentally shoot people until they take away his certification to teach people how to fire a gun safely? Apparently, at this point, it's not two. Maybe he's got to do it three times. Just a wonderful story about how if you have the proper gun safety course, then guns, of course, are incredibly safe. Let's go to the IMs, Left Coast Marcus. What's up with the Sammy cam? You look like you're in a hostage video. Do I still look like that? I think that was probably just the sense that my family's around, and I get that quality. Movie pick, Red Dawn on Movie Central tonight. Wolverines. I imagine you're talking about the original one. Triangle Bill, audio is good on the iOS app. Live feed on YouTube, it's working, but enormous delay. Audio streaming, regular websites, it seems to be working fine now. Okay, great. A Square, Sam, catching up on podcasts this week. Not sure if you covered Obama's tour with Cliff today. Higher education, a big issue, but he seems to have picked up the least controversial policy to go to the stump instead of a more meaty issue. Your thoughts? Have a great vacation. Frankly, I haven't paid too much attention. I know he's got some proposals about higher education. I've been digging into the Common Core curriculum. I have some ambivalence about it. But the problem is, of course, with all of this is that it's being imposed through a high-stakes testing regime. It is being imposed from a top-down type of situation where you're not giving any flexibility for teachers to be able to teach. It's the wrong approach, although I'm not sure I have really a problem with the curriculum itself. It's just that the way it is being imposed, I think, is sort of problematic. But when we get back from vacation, as we move into September, I'm hoping to talk more about education at different times during the course of the show. We've had more or less emphasis on things like education. And after an extended period where we haven't had as much emphasis, I want to refocus on that, particularly because I'm convinced that, well, maybe at least just because it's closer to me, but my hope is that we're going to see a Mayor Bill Blasio who is, at least it occurs to me, will be more amenable to being pushed on education in directions that hopefully could set some type of model for the rest of the country. We'll see. Calhoun John on the IM. Another good summer of shows. This is my last live show. Summer break is ending, and I am back to school on Monday. Well, Calhoun, I'm glad that you enjoyed the summer of show. In fact, Monday's agenda, you write, includes a four-hour meeting about the Common Core. I mean, there also seems to be, from what I can tell, a real problem with its implementation, aside from the problem with its development, that it seems to have been rushed. It's very hard to know. I mean, one of my biggest frustrations as a polemicist, I guess, in reading up about educational matters is that the genuine educators, the ones who I think are being shut out of the process and the ones who, frankly, have the most to offer the process, they're not the way that they view education, which in my estimation is the proper way, which is you can't have a one-size-fits-all type of situation. To teach, what you need to know first is who's your student. And then you derive a plan based upon your students. Now, it's one thing to go into, you're a second grade teacher. Every second grade, you have a broad set of parameters on where you want to go with the class. But how you go there and at what pace and is a function of who the kids in your class are. And the people who are the best at that, who are most sensitive to the need for that in an educational environment, also seem to be really, really loath or not equipped to make a more reductive argument about it because it's not in their nature. And so the qualities that you want in an educator, that is nuance and sensitivity to context and sensitivity to audience is maybe not sensitivity to audience, but tailoring based on an audience, but staying true to a message, it is not helpful from a polemical standpoint. And in many respects, that seems to be like that and the massive amounts of money that stand on the other side of this in the reform movement, the so-called reform movement. It's frustrating. It's frustrating, but it's also frustrating because it means that I need to become better educated on the topic because it's harder to tease out in some respects. And, I try, but, J. Tingle, I know what the anger is within Ben Affleck. It relates to his mysterious hair. Is there such a mystery around the Ben Affleck's hair? I'm just not aware of it, but I mean, I'll believe you if you say that's the case. All right, let's go to the phones. Hopefully we've got the phones working here. You're calling from a 323 area code. Hold on. Hopefully this is, are you there?
It's Kim. Yeah, they're kind of working. I'm just turned off my computer. I'm calling from Los Angeles. I totally hope you focus on education. In Los Angeles, we're at the epicenter of all this privatization stuff. And, you know, in New York, the bankers own everything. In Los Angeles, the developers own everything. And they want the money. I mean, it's the only place where government is spending any money, which is on education, and they want the money. Anyways, I don't really want to talk about education. I'll just say that Diane Rabbit has a new book coming up, coming out soon. You might want to interview her.
I've tried with Diane Rabbit. Yes.
I was shocked that his attorney asked for 25 years for him instead of asking for, like, well, how about 10 minutes more? You know, and time served. The guy's a whistleblower. You let him go. I just didn't get why he was asking for 25 years.
Yeah, you know, I'm not clear on that either. I gotta check into that. But I'm not sure what was behind that, frankly. I think it was, you know, part of it could have been that there was an awareness that they had pled guilty to a certain number of those counts, which that would have equaled 25 years. I don't know if it was because the judge had already basically ruled on the implications of Manning's time at Quantico, wherein she was, you know, arguably tortured. And one would have think that that maybe would have mitigated the rest of her sentence. I don't know. That's a good question, Kim. And I'm going to look more into that. Over break. But in the meantime, send me an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com if you have any suggestions as to people who have been writing about those educational issues out in L.A.
Yeah, okay. I can sort of barely hear you. We're having technical issues. I don't know if it's me or you or whatever. But look, have a great vacation and see you when you get back.
Okay, thanks, Kim.
Or listen to you. Hello?
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Apologies, folks. I think I just may not have the bandwidth here. I may just not have the bandwidth to be able to call too well on this situation. I have another idea, though. Let me see if this works. Bear with me, folks. If we get another call, I will take that. We're going to go a little long today. Majority Report, Zach, on the IM says, President Obama is hosting a town hall discussion at my alma mater, SUNY Binghamton, about, affordable higher education. I have a Majority Report exclusive. Obama said nothing interesting in the least eloquent way possible. I mean, I think, you know, look, I don't know. There's that program out in Oregon. I don't know what there is for the federal government to do other than to provide more funding for states that the states should be funding themselves anyways at this point, as far as I'm concerned. And that seems unlikely to happen, particularly with this Congress. So I don't know, but I think really the big push that we should be seeing is for an increased minimum wage. Beyond that, I don't know what else the president I don't know what else the president is doing. I mean, I guess this is a way to sort of motivate young people for the off-year election, but you know. We just heard from presumably a young person who was not terribly impressed with what they heard. Sheila Collins, I don't know if you've seen this, but Hulu has a great documentary about Don Rickles called Mr. Warmth. Great pick about an amazing comedian. I haven't. Definitely interested. I will check it out. Fry Pop Phil, it's a disappointment there's no interest in investigating the abuses of government that day after day we hear more info released. But we don't want the trial for impeachment to learn about the depth of these crimes. Where do you think we would have been with the criminal acts of Nixon if he never faced impeachment? If he never faced, I guess we went too far then, and now we just sit and watch the death. The dead bodies pile up and civil rights violations become expected norms. I'm not sure what you mean by dead bodies piling up. But, you know, we've got hearings that are going to take place in the Senate. Leahy, we've got a strong pushback in Congress. I think, you know, that I think, frankly, that these revelations are being met with, if not the the broader interest I would want to see from liberals or the population at large, I think we're seeing at least some response on a legislative standpoint. So, but I guess that remains to be seen. All right, let's take one more IM, and then I think we're done. We just may not have we just may not have the bandwidth to do all the different things that we need to do from here. Calhoun John for the final IM before the vacation. I have had hours of training about Common Core, and nobody can explain what it really is, but that's the norm in education. Well, apparently there's an app, Calhoun John. All right, folks, Matt and Mike will be here Monday. I will be back live a week from Tuesday. The app will be released a week after that. Have a great Labor Day in the meantime, and we'll see you then. Okay, we will see you later. Oh, wait a second. Wait a second. Late breaking news. Hold on. Come on in. We've got one more thing to do here, ladies and gentlemen. Come on in. Check one, two. Let's go. Come on in here. No, no, no. Come on this side, sweetie. Come on over here. I've got a guest here that I think we all want to talk to. What is your name, young lady?
My name is Myla Suter. You might recognize my voice from singing the Moves Like Jagger and We're Dancing. Yeah.
All right. And just give us a sense now. I don't know if people have heard your response to having a younger brother. Just you were an only child for about 7.5 years.
Yes.
And what? Can you sit in the chair? Well, no. Daddy's sitting in the chair. I need to end the show. Okay, so why don't you just come over here and just answer that question. What's it like now being a big sister.
I love being a big sister. It's actually really great. I think it's good, but the sad
talking
thing,
to the mic.
But the sad thing was, Saul had his first
talking to the mic.
Saul had his first throw up last night.
Yeah,
it was green. But anyone who ever feels gross about that, I'm really sorry to say, but I just had to say it on this radio show. But anyway, yes.
So. All right, so say see you in a week.
See you guys in a week. I hope we have fun out of vacation.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright.
choice is made for the option where you don't get paid.